Hold your finger at 1 Corinthians 11 and turn over to chapter 13 and back up one verse at the end of chapter 12 is a verse, and it's the second sentence in that verse I call your attention to, and I still show you a more excellent way. Now, the translators have put that, or whoever put the verse divisions in, chapter divisions, at the end of chapter 12. You know that was done by men. But clearly, if you're familiar with chapter 13, you know that last statement actually is a heading, if you want to call it that, for what's in chapter 13. The more excellent way over spiritual gifts is love. So what this highlights is what we know, that sometimes chapter divisions really interrupt the flow. And so that's something we need to be careful of as we study it. Men put those divisions there. Now you can go back to 1 Corinthians 11. You have this first line in the chapter. Be imitators of me, just as I also am of Christ. Now, if we're not familiar with the concept we just talked about, that may look like a statement out of the blue. What's in the world is he talking about, imitating him? Is it just a general statement to that he's an example of godly living, or what? Of obeying the gospel, or whatever. But you have a context. That context is chapters 8, 9, and 10. We talked about those three chapters being linked together with the concept of rights, particularly the right to eat meat offered to idols. And then Paul stated his views. I'm not going to go back and read the verses, but 8:13, he said, I won't eat meat if it caused my brother to stumble. Chapter 9, he talked about, I forfeit my right to be supported for the sake of saving others. And then if you will look at chapter 10 and verse 33, the verse just previous to chapter 11, 1. Just as I please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of many, that they may be saved. In this case, 11, 1 goes with the previous chapter, if I understand it. Be imitators of me. Imitate that attitude, that he would put his preferences or liberties behind the good and welfare, spiritual welfare of others. And he discussed that in chapter 8, chapter 9, and chapter 10. So that's just a thing to note as we look at that. He said, imitate me as I also am of Christ. In Philippians chapter 2, he showed Christ had that attitude when he was talking about the spirit of humility and considering others more than yourself, how Christ left the glories of heaven to come and be a man and die the death of the cross. So he's our ultimate example of not putting self first and the conveniences of self, but being willing to do things to serve others. So that's just a thought as you look at chapter 11, verse 1. Now, chapter 11, verse 2 through 16, all seem to be grouped together by their content on the subject that we might call the covering. Now, when we talk about the covering, there's a lot of varying views about the covering. And some of the brethren that I highly respect and love differ with me on this particular section of verses. It has not diminished at all my respect for them. I believe they're godly people and they love the truth. But we differ on it. And so we encourage you, as we study together, to study for yourself, make your own conclusions. But I'm going to present to you, in the few minutes we have, at least a concept that I believe underlies this particular section of Scripture. So we have, first of all, on the lesson, five primary views that you will find in literature that men write, in sermons that you may hear, or maybe even within a congregation, there'll be people who have these different views. So, number one, that the artificial covering is required in worship. And there are places in the United States you may go and visit where nearly every woman has some kind of artificial covering on her hair, on her head, during the time they're gathered for worship. They may remove it after the worship is over. Now, those people who do that, I do not question their sincerity, their desire to serve God. I just differ with them as to if that's what this verse is requiring. When we get to verse 16, you'll see on the lesson, each one I have verse 16. We'll talk about that some more. That's a key passage as to how you view this whole section, if I understand verse 16. Now, the second position you will find is that the artificial covering in the passage, he's saying that it was required when women who were empowered with spiritual gifts exercised those gifts in the assembly, or maybe even not in the assembly, that they had to wear the artificial covering when praying or prophesying. You know that prophesying is a spiritual gift, that is, one that you cannot exercise without the Holy Spirit empowering you. And they also had those kind of prayers. You see that in chapter 14. And so they feel like it was something that was pertinent to that time when spiritual gifts were active, and that if women exercised those gifts to show they were still respecting the leadership of the man, that they had to wear some kind of artificial covering. And there's very capable men that have argued that position. I just happen to differ with them. I do not believe that's what the passage is teaching. The third position is that the covering in the text is not an artificial covering at all. That the covering he's talking about is a woman's hair. Once again, some men that I love and respect dearly hold that position. We've talked about it, written back and forth about it. But there's still a difference in our view. But their view is that the hair is the covering. And one of these brethren particularly, a couple of them I know, believe that the words that Paul used indicate that the hair has to be long enough to hang down from the head. So that if a woman has a haircut like my wife's haircut, they would think that is not scriptural. It doesn't hang down from the head. And so again, I worship with these men. I've learned from these men. I respect them. I just differ with them on this particular passage. And we'll see more about that as we continue through the study. The fourth idea, this was an idea my son Daniel came up with many years ago when he was studying it, is that there's dialogue in this chapter. If you were here when Keith taught on chapter 6, you remember he introduced the concept of dialogue that Paul used in chapter 6. It's also in chapter 8. Dialogue is a figure of speech that was used in various places in the Bible. You find it, for example, in the Old Testament, where like in the Song of Solomon, it'll change from speaker to speaker to speaker. You have to read the text to figure it out. Now, Bibles will put the speaker out in the margin, but you'll find the Bibles differ, the translators differ as to who the speaker is. You have to figure it out. And so, the same is true in other prophecies of the Old Testament, prophetic works. So, we know that there is some dialogue in 1 Corinthians. I'm not persuaded that is the case here, although this particular point has some very worthy points to be considered. But you can do that if you wish on your own time. But that's a position that's held. In the end, this Dan, my son who studied this, comes to the same conclusion I do, that while it was an artificial covering, it had to do with a custom in Corinth at the time. But the idea that dictation is there is something that you can consider if you wish, and I've got further notes on that if you're interested in it. What I believe that the text has to do with is a local custom, a custom in the Corinthian society, and that these verses have to do with how that impacted a woman wearing an artificial covering. Now, we're going to look at some of the, what I believe the evidence is that that is the case. And so down in verse 13, you'll see he appeals here clearly to something they were familiar with. Not, this is not turning to a verse of scripture in the Old Testament. He said, judge for yourselves, is it proper? We'll look at that. And that had to do with whether a woman ought to have long hair and what it symbolized by her long hair or short hair. But that was something that they, in their society, without a Bible in hand, would say, yes, that's what long hair or short hair symbolizes. And I think the similarity between that and the artificial covering is in view, that in their society, a woman wearing a covering sent some kind of a message, or the failure to wear a covering or to have her hair cut off. But that was in their local society. So, if we have time, you'll note on your lesson, I've got compare the customs of washing feet and holy kiss. And if we have time, we can look at that. I don't know that we will in our class this morning. You know that there was a custom in the first century, people wore sandals, and when they would come to someone's house and hospitality was extended to them, they would either give them a bucket to wash their feet, or they might, as an act of humility, themselves wash their feet. And Jesus used that custom in John 13 to teach his apostles, who had a pride problem, that their work was one of humble ministry. Because he said, I'm your Lord and Master, and I'm going to wash your feet. He was teaching them humble service. You do not find foot washing in the early churches as a practice, or taught or practiced in the early churches. But he took a local custom to teach a lesson on humility. The same thing is true throughout your New Testament letters. Not everyone, but several talk about greet one another with a holy kiss. We don't greet with a kiss. That was their custom. So if I'm correct about that, he's not saying use a kiss to greet one another. They did that. He's regulating the custom with a holy kiss is the idea. That there's pure motives involved and pure actions involved when you do it. So there are a couple examples of customs where that were used to teach lessons, but the custom itself was not something that Christians were bound by. We don't wash feet today. We don't greet by kissing today. But the principles are still involved and lessons for us today. But the rest of the time we have together, we're going to look at the evidence that I believe shows that the covering is a local custom for women to have an artificial covering. Now, you'll see on your lesson, very first thing, that custom. Custom is what people do on a regular basis, kind of like a habit. Custom can be established by personal habit. You're familiar with Hebrews 10:25. Do not forsake the assembling of yourselves together as is. Now, some versions say the custom of some. Some say the habit of some. And so a person starts missing, and they would, because of the pressure, the oppression, the persecution they would suffer, and they wouldn't meet with the saints. And it may be difficult the first time, maybe less difficult the second time. After a while, they wouldn't meet at all. And they had developed a habit or a custom that they do not meet with the saints. And so that was nothing the law prescribed. In fact, he cautions them against practicing that custom in that passage. And but it was something that they had simply developed by their own personal habits, and it became customary for them not to assemble with the saints when they met. John 18:39, you're familiar with that passage. This was when Jesus was on trial, and Pilate knew he was innocent, and he wanted to release him. And he said, "You have a custom that I release someone." He wanted to release a known violent offender, Barabbas, because he knew Jesus was innocent. They didn't want that. He wanted to release Jesus. Excuse me, I got it backwards. Instead of Barabbas, they didn't want that. They wanted Jesus crucified and Barabbas, the known criminal, to be set free. But that was not a law. That was something that in their society, I guess once in a year, the ruler, the governor in this case, Pilate, would do to appease the Jewish people. "I'll release one of your famous prisoners," and I guess gain their favor in some way. So this was not a personal habit. It was a habit of the rulers and the society at that time, the governmental actions of that day. Then in Acts chapter 15, verse 1, you know there was a big debate that had been taking place among churches about whether or not Gentiles had to be circumcised and keep the law of Moses to be saved. And Paul, as you know, and Barnabas engaged in a debate with those who believe that. As Luke writes about this in chapter 15, verse 1, he said, "Some men came from down from Judea and began teaching the brethren, unless you be circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved." So by custom here, he means the law. It's a practice that was practiced by males for hundreds of years by virtue of the fact that it was part of the law of Moses. The question is, was it now applicable to the idea of receiving the blessings of the gospel? And that was the debate. But you can see that custom grew out of actually law. So we have the word custom here in chapter 11 and verse 16. This version, New American, translates it practice. Some of your versions translate it custom. It's that word. You can use the word custom or practice. You could use that in Hebrews 11. Some have that habit or that practice. And so it's talking about something that people do on a repeated basis. All right, so why do I think that the covering of this chapter, and we know all through we have the idea of covering, we'll see that as we read the verses, does not involve something that grows out of divine law or that men are to practice today, that is women to practice today, but involve local custom. First of all, point number one, a covering did not always signify authority. If you read the verses in Genesis chapter 38, when Judah saw a woman covered up, did it say, "I love God and I respect my husband," or what did it say to Judah? What did it say? She's a prostitute. So at that time, in that society, this woman knew how to dress to advertise, "I'm a prostitute." She was trying to ensnare Judah, which she did. But you could see that the covering was not a sign of, "I respect you as a man," or "I respect my husband," at all in that time and in that society. And that is recorded for us by the Holy Spirit. Now, in Exodus 34 and 33 and 34, if you read those verses, Moses wore a covering, put on a covering. What was the circumstances surround Moses wearing a covering? Did it have to do with women, with a wife, or what? What was the circumstances? Did anybody read those verses and remember what the setting was? Remember, he went in to talk with God in the tent, and his face would go. And he'd come out and cover his face, maybe his whole head. And some think the veil did that. In some societies today, a veil covers a woman's entire head. But it had nothing to do with man-woman relationship, had nothing to do with authority. It had to do with he had been speaking in the presence of God. When he came out, the people were afraid, and so he put a veil on his face. So again, nothing to do with the connotation of a covering in 1 Corinthians 11. And so, 1 Corinthians 11, verse 7, he said, "A man ought not to have his head covered, since he's the image and glory of God." Whatever he's talking about here is based on some eternal principles. He's the image and glory of God. That's been true from the first man to walk the earth and will be to the last man is removed from the earth. And the woman is the glory of the man. The man does not originate from the woman, but the woman from the man. Man was not created for the woman's sake, but the woman for the man's sake. So these are basic principles that's always been true since there was man and woman. And so it's not like Genesis, it's not like Exodus, but it's based on principles that are always true. Now, the fact that it's based on principles that are always true is what leads some to believe the practice engaged or discussed here ought to be practiced today, and we'll talk some more about that. I just want you to show that when you read covering here and it's associated with the idea of authority, note verse 10, a woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head, that was not always the connotation of a covering in the Bible. So that made you to wonder, is this something unique to this particular time and maybe this particular place, that a woman wearing an artificial covering said something about authority? I don't know what "because of the angels" means, but be that as it may, you can see that there was something about wearing that said, I respect the fact that the man has authority. Okay, so that's point number one. Number two, so you say, okay, if this has to do with generally a woman respecting a man's authority, his leadership in the family as God ordained it, we would say, well, there are some other verses along that line. And so I put on your lesson verses about woman subjection throughout the Scriptures. Now, if I've missed one that discussing that subject and mentions the idea of she wearing a covering to demonstrate that, you tell me after class and I'll add it to my notes. But in all these verses, the first time, Genesis 3, where the woman is subjected to the man. In Ephesians 5, where the woman is to respect her husband, just like she respects Christ's leadership. Colossians 3, the same thing. Same thing in 1 Timothy 2, a woman is not to have authority over the man. Same thing in Titus 2 and 1 Peter 3. So all these verses discuss that subject, a woman's relationship to men, and particularly to the man that is her husband. Not one time in all of those verses, and as far as I know, and again, I could be missing one, the idea of that relationship being depicted by her wearing some kind of a covering is never, ever discussed except right here in this letter at this time, about 57 A.D., so that's just something I thought was interesting. You would think that with this responsibility between the man and the woman, particularly on the part of the woman, being such an important factor in the relationship that pleases God, you might find something else about it somewhere. It's also interesting that in this particular passage in 1 Corinthians 11, he talks about women who are praying and prophesying ought to be covered. And they had praying and prophesying women back then. Was Deborah a prophesying woman? Yeah, she was a prophet. And we've got the verse there in Judges 4, 4 and 5. Was Huldah a prophesying woman? Yeah, she was a prophet. So you can't say, well, this was in the New Testament church where women prayed and prophesied. You had women prophesying throughout the religious history of the Old Testament. Miriam prophesied in that song she wrote. And then, of course, it says that Anna, this elderly woman that was at the temple, when she talked about Jesus and his role, evidently prophesied. So, again, we know that women did have this spiritual gift, and yet still nothing about them wearing some artificial covering to say, I still recognize my role with a man and his authority over women, and particularly my husband. So I just found that interesting that that's absent from all the other passages where you might think you'd find some allusion to this if it was a general law for all time, for all people, for all women recognizing man's authority. Okay, now, number three. You'll note he talks about in the chapter here the shame for a woman in an uncovered state or when she's shorn or shaven. Let's read verse 5. Every woman who has her head uncovered while praying or prophesying disgraces her head. For she is one and the same as the woman whose head is shaved. For if a woman does not cover her head, let her also have her hair cut off. But if it's disgraceful for a woman to have her hair cut off or her head shaved, let her cover her head. So there was something about this that was dishonorable for this woman, that was shameful for this woman. Now, what is the shame of a shorn or shaven state? So, and how did one come to such an understanding? Was this a general teaching that you read about throughout the Bible, that a woman who had her hair cut off, that was some kind of shameful thing to her, that she ought to be going hiding until her hair regrew or something like that? You'll note here we have some passages in the Old Testament. And again, we simply don't have time to read the passages. And that's one reason we hand out these lessons ahead of time, hopefully that people will go and do their own research. But you can go look this up if you wish. In these passages that we have, Deuteronomy 21, Job 1, Jeremiah 7, and Jeremiah 16, and Amos 8, the idea of shaving the head or cutting the hair was a sign of mourning, not of shame, personal shame, that I've done something that I shouldn't have done. It may be mourning because they're punished for their sin. That's another matter. But it was a sign of mourning. And so there's nothing about mourning here in this text, that woman does it as a sign of mourning. Rather, it's an act she ought not do, ought not have her hair cut or short or shaved, because it would be a disgrace to her. And so it seems that the Scriptures is not the source from which that idea came from. So where did they get the idea that, where did Paul write to these Corinthians that it's a shame for a woman to have her hair shaven or shorn? Where did they get that idea? Not from reading the Bible, unless I've missed it somewhere. Now, if it was a local custom practiced in that locality, yeah, I can understand that. That they derive that from practice of their society. But I don't see anywhere in Revelation, not the book of Revelation, but divine revelation, the Bible, that supports that particular idea. Then number four, in verse 13 through 15, it is said that nature taught them three things. So let's read 13, 14, and 15. Judge for yourselves. So again, he's appealing to their own judgment. Look around you. Just observe the society you're in and how men live and think. Judge for yourselves. Is it proper? Now, he quotes an Old Testament verse. This is based on their own experience in Corinth in 57 A.D. Not in Ephesus, not in Macedonia, not in Philippi, not in Jerusalem. This is in Corinth. Judge for yourselves. I don't know if these people ever had been to those other cities. Remember, they didn't have airplanes back then to be able to travel like we do today. So you judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered. Does not even nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it is a dishonor to him? But if a woman has long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given her for a covering. The word nature, we talked about this in a class just recently. The word nature has several connotations. And a failure to understand that can lead to serious error. We talked about that in Ephesians chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. Calvinism uses that verse to say, man is born sinful. By nature, you're children of wrath. But that's, while that's one meaning of the word can mean practice. The practice of society. Like we say, it's natural for women to wear lipstick or toenail polish. It's not inborn, it's a practice in our society. And the context of Ephesians 2, 1 through 3 shows that they're being judged not for Adam's sin, but for their own life of sin. And then the law of harmony forbids that kind of interpretation as well. So we see that the word nature, when you run across it, must be interpreted contextually and by the law of harmony. And so, in our particular text, we're looking at nature. Not nature taught the first. It was long hair was a shame for a man. Well, that was true. He says, you judge for yourselves. They would say, yes, I see that. But did the scriptures, did they get that from the scriptures? Was that from reading the Bible they came to that conclusion? Look at 2 Samuel chapter 14, verse 25 and 26. So here's David's son, Absalom. David's son, Absalom. Now, I realize the nation, there was a lot of depravity in the nation, but not everybody was corrupt. This is the time of David the king, writing of the Psalms. And there were some righteous people in that nation. But Absalom, his son, was praised, you remember why? For his long hair. So they didn't have the same view about long hair that's being expressed in this chapter. And if you'd asked those people at that time, judge for yourselves, how does a long hair dishonor a man? They said, no. They're ready to make him king. And so that was not true in that particular society at that particular time. In Judges chapter 13 and Judges chapter 16, you have the story of Samson. His parents wanted a child, and God granted their prayer. And so Samson was born. And they were instructed that a razor was not to come on his head. He was not to cut his hair. He was designated by God to be a judge, a deliverer of the people. If you'd have asked those people, Samson's long hair, isn't that shameful? What would their society have said? Absolutely not. He's our warrior. He's our savior. He's our judge. And it was by God's direction that in this case, he had long hair. If it's universally true and true for all time that it's a shame for men to have long hair, why would God tell a man who was to be the leader of the people not to cut his hair? And so it seems like this statement that it's a shame for men to have long hair was not a universal concept in scriptures, at least, and they didn't get it from the scriptures. In Numbers chapter 6, there might be a man who wanted to specially dedicate himself to the Lord, and he took what was called a Nazirite vow. So here's a man who particularly wants to be dedicated to God. One of the requirements for this vow was you don't cut your hair. So you see a Nazirite, you say, well, that's shameful. No, it's honorable. This man devoted himself to God for this vow. Again, they didn't get this concept that you're reading about here from reading the Bible. I know of no place in the Bible that it indicates that was a universal concept. And then in 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 11, the truth was with Samuel that he was not to have his hair cut. One of the greatest prophets that you read about in the Old Testament. A man of God, a man of courage, a man of faith. And so, and that's why I put in bold the sentence, the scriptures do not seem to to teach this either as law or as universally recognized. And these verses here, I think, substantiate that. All right, the second idea is that a woman to have long hair was her glory. And the third one, that a woman's hair was given her for a covering. We've already talked about the covering idea, that we find that nowhere else in the Bible, that a covering would indicate submission to men or to her husband. So the question is, where did they get this idea? He says, look around you. Your society. And apparently in this local society, that was the practice, that men had short hair and women had long hair. And it symbolized something to their society. And so if in their society a woman having long hair was a glory, short hair was a shame, if you're a woman in that society, what do you want to do with your hair? You want to have it long because it sends a message. That's the idea. Did it do that in Ephesus or Philippi or Jerusalem? There's no indication of that, nor across the board. So a woman might have her hair cut when she was mourning for something, not because it's a shameful act. Okay, so,
Steve,
yes.
In your research, have you found that it may have some roots in idolatry because of the Corinthian area and the Corinthian members?
That's possible. When I've tried to find out what the customs were, you're going to find, if you do the research on secular writers, the only place you can get that, you're going to find a variety of things is what you're going to find. You have to be real careful. Two or three things. One, the commentator may quote somebody, but when did that guy live? Did he live in the 50s of the first century, or did he live 200 years earlier, or 400 years earlier? Did he live there, or did he live somewhere else? And so that's a good point, Doug, and to do research, see what idolaters practice. But what idolaters practice necessarily in one place may not be true what idolaters practice in another place. I don't know. That is an interesting study, and I've got a bunch of notes about that. But and it's a good point that Doug raises. And it may well have been. I don't know. But if it is an idolatrous practice for women to have long hair and to wear a covering, I don't know that Paul would encourage it, because it would send that kind of a message. Just like the eating of meat's okay, but if it sends the message, I believe in this idol, don't do it. So I would have questions whether or not he'd encourage it if it's associated with allegiance to idolatry. Good point, Doug. So I've got here this paragraph. If nature is the general sense and practice of their society, this accords with four things in the text. One, the appeal to judge within themselves. Not over here in the book of Micah or the book of Isaiah. Judge within yourselves. So you do that based on your experience and your society. Remember, there, this is a long time ago. They don't have automobiles. They don't have planes. They don't have a television to see what's going on in the other part of the world. It's their society. Two, the word custom. It would agree with the idea that custom refers to a local custom, not something universal across continents and centuries. Thirdly, the information in the rest of the scripture about hair and being shaven that we've already appealed to, it would concur with the fact that those do not establish this as a sign of a woman's subjection and respect for authority. And then observation today. So here we are today. I know our nation, our country's corrupt, the world's corrupt. But is that true across the board? Does a woman having short hair in the church where you may attend mean she doesn't respect men and she doesn't respect her husband? Do you even think that when you see that? Or that if a woman has long hair, she's a particularly godly woman? In our society, unless I'm mistaken, that is not the case. You say, well, what? Have we just lost it? Have we become totally depraved? Or does this point to what we're saying, that a local custom was involved? All right, so let's go to verse 16. I've only got 2 or 3 minutes, but that's an important verse, verse 16. And I think it's a key verse to the entire chapter. He said, but if one is inclined to be contentious, we have no other practice. Now, there's 3 positions about this. One, that the custom is of being contentious. 2, that the custom is of women being uncovered. And 3, that the custom was of women being covered. For sake of time, I can't cover this like I would like. The fact that it's the custom of being contentious, you can read the notes if you wish. I'll summarize. Throughout the Corinthian letter and in other places, when Paul wanted to establish apostolic tradition, which was authoritative, he did so positively. Here's what the apostles teach or do, not negatively. We don't have that practice. But so if that's what he was doing, why not do it like he did it in chapter 4 or in chapter 14 and in other places, so that you can read those verses and see that for yourself. And there were contentious men in Corinth who did not believe in the apostleship of Paul. And so if you were saying this is apostolic precedent, you don't do that because I'm an apostle. These men said, we are apostles too. So what? You can read that in 2 Corinthians, that there was that problem there. So that seems to undermine the idea that it's an apostolic precedent type statement. The custom of women being uncovered, that Paul was setting apostolic precedent, that women ought to be uncovered. And we've already talked about chapter 7, chapter 14, where he did that positively. Now, the translations had a difficulty when they translated this verse. They obviously did not believe what I'm teaching. That is, he's saying, we have no such practice, nor have the churches of God. They thought it was, he was saying, the churches of God have this practice. So they completely changed the word. The word is such. You can go look it up. The New American Standard, I use the New American Standard. It's a good version. But the translators put diametrically opposite word, other. Such and other are opposites. Now, in the footnote of the New American Standard, it will tell you, literally, such. But translators don't know what to do with that because that sounds like nobody practices it. That's exactly what he's saying. I'm in Ephesus. The church at Ephesus doesn't have the practice, and that's why we don't observe the custom. And it's not a universal practice among churches of God because they don't have the practice. So here are these false teachers. If they want to dishonor Paul, they say, he's teaching one thing to you fellas, but over there where he's at and other churches where he teaches, they don't practice it. He'll teach it there. You can't trust that guy. Would they do that? Yes. They accuse Paul of being two-faced. You read 2 Corinthians chapter 1, for example, and in other places. Yes, they'd appeal to that. So if this is a local custom and they're saying, well, this is not universal, Paul. No, it's not universal. You know why? We don't have a custom. That's why. We have no such custom here. So these instructions would not apply here. But you do have the custom. Therefore, you ought to observe it, just like the eating of meats. You go to the marketplace, you buy meat, you don't wonder, when was this bought? Was this meat killed by somebody that's an idolater and maybe first blessed to the idol? No, you don't worry about that. We don't, not that kind of a society. And so anyway, I'm out of time. At least maybe we gave you an overview for you to think about. Again, if you're interested in further, I've got further notes on it. But I encourage you to do your own study and your own thinking. We're only interested in truth. We have no denominational doctrine to uphold, but simply a pursuit for truth. Thank you for your attention this morning.